Good morning. Hi.
Hi.
This morning I'm going to talk a little bit about continuous practice and giving some examples, some contemporary examples. It's a term that Dogen talks about a lot, without much explanation or illustration. So some of us are in retreat today. About a dozen of us have been in retreat for 5 days. This is our fifth day. And in retreat, we don't talk, as most of you know, but some of you probably don't even know that. We don't talk. So we haven't talked. Of course, I've sat up here and talked. And Lee has sat up here and talked, because Lee's been my partner in this. But nobody else talks. And that's interesting. That's an interesting way to do continuous practice, is not to talk. Part of what that's about is that our talking to ourselves and to each other covers over, conceals some expression that's always going on, some language that's always going on at a more subtler, deeper level with our bodies, our body language. Just interesting to watch people. I sit here, so I watch everybody during the retreat. I watch them move for 5 days. Of course, I don't see myself, but I see them, and I see their language. I really see their language, their nonverbal language, and hopefully they feel it too. Usually, we're so unaware of it. We're so unaware of the language of the trees outside, the language of the grass. The lake has been changing color so many times, speaking in its own voice, as Dogen would say, its own voice. So that's one of the reasons we don't talk, so that we can experience language at a deeper level, which is not just this conceptual language. And Dogen calls that wholehearted expression. Wholehearted expression, which is a part of continuous practice, a key component of continuous practice. And of course, as our minds begin to calm down, we hear that language more. We feel it more. We see it more. Norman Fisher says that all language is singing. That's kind of cool, isn't it? All language is singing. Including the concepts. It's singing. But we hold on to words as if they refer to objects that exist. That's the problem. We think they refer to objects that really exist, and we suffer. We suffer. And it's interesting that the historical Buddha didn't recommend that his words be written down. He didn't recommend that. And possibly that's because he understood the ever-shifting nature of language, the ever-moving, malleable nature of language. So one of the things that we do in retreat, or we try to do, is pay attention, also in just daily sitting, in daily meditation, pay attention to the way we talk to ourselves. Try to pay attention, so that we can break free of any need to reify it, to make it believe that it's the true picture, and just enjoy it as one picture instead. So when I was having a one-to-one meeting with someone in retreat, the very beginning, at the second day of retreat, this person's first day, this person was talking about different ways in which they talk to themselves. And we discussed four ways in which this person talks to herself, which is pretty common for all of us. But it was her idea, not mine. The first way is that come into a retreat. You have a busy day, a busy week. You've been doing. First way you talk to yourself is finally you've got some chance to work things out in your head. Finally you've got some chance to a little problem solving in your head. Because all week you've been going. Second way, and this is just what came out of the interview that I had. Second way, subconscious stuff. When the mind begins to calm down, all kinds of kind of weird stuff comes up. Subconscious stuff. Interesting, though. And sometimes just totally irrelevant. It's like sort of a waking dream. Third way, obsessive thoughts. We don't have to go into that, right? Over and over and over again. Our OCD nature. The ego has an OCD nature. Fourth way, daydreaming. Plenty of time to daydream in retreat. Wow. Wow. And the person I was talking to and I agreed that maybe it's better for the first two ways, working problems out and subconscious stuff, just to give your horse a large pasture. Suzuki Roshi's words. If you want to tame your horse, give it a large pasture. These problems maybe need to be worked out. let them be worked out rather than trying to mess with them. This subconscious stuff is just going to come up. Let it come up rather than trying to mess with it. But the third and the fourth one, the obsessions over and over and over again, and the daydreaming, call for some intervention. Call for some focus on your breathing, cosmic mudra. We call this cosmic mudra, how we hold our hands. On your whatever, to bring you back, to focus. Or the obsessing, you just spend the whole 40 minutes obsessing. Geez, you might as well just be home watching TV. At least that would be more relaxing, wouldn't it? So that's what we agreed on. I think that's pretty good. That's pretty good. But it might not be good for you. You have to experience this. You have to practice this. So Suzuki Roshi's, my teacher's, one of his favorite sayings was the Zen teacher who said to himself every day, at least once a day, and whenever necessary, don't be fooled by anything, and then replied, I won't be. Simple, but takes you have to do it. You have to do it. Language and words, so important actually to in Zen as in life, and master of language, who still studied in literature departments a lot, is Sigmund Freud. Now, psychology departments aren't so interested in Sigmund Freud anymore, but literature departments are. It's very interesting. When I was very young in psychology, they were interested in Freud, but not anymore. Now, mostly literature departments. Because Freud knew how to use language. He knew how to look into the psyche with language and bring it into awareness. From my point of view, Freud was expressing ancient Buddhist psychology and he just didn't know it. But that's my bias, right? So, is three basic concepts, id, superego, and ego, you find really present in Buddhist psychology very much. Id is our impulsive reactions, the samskaras, our impulses. Our primitive impulses, primal impulses. Primitive puts them down. Let's just say primal. Our primal impulses for affection, for food, for physical comfort, for sex, our primal. And then superego, the should, the internal parent. And then ego, from Freud's point of view, ego is trying to balance these two, trying to keep the impulses in line, but not have the superego smash the impulses so there's no enjoyment of simple pleasures. So Freud sees the ego as the arbiter, sees the internal dialogue as the arbiter, continually trying to balance these two, the impulses and then the rider of the impulses, the should, the internal parent. And that's all good stuff and present in Buddhism, although talked about somewhat differently. And of course in Buddhism we also say, this is the key, that there's possible to be free from the constraints of these three. The constraints of impulse, the constraints of shooting our life away, and parenting, internally parenting our lives away, and then always trying to arbitrate by talking to ourselves. But we need to know all three of these. We need to get real close to all three of these, we don't see the space. We don't see the opportunity. We don't see that they don't refer to anything either. But yet they're very helpful constructs. Very helpful constructs. So I'm going to use my grandson as an example again. My eldest grandson. So when he was four, now he's five. When he was four and his brother was one, he came to visit us. He brought Thomas the Train with him, all the way from France, because he told his mama he couldn't come leave home without Thomas the Train. His mama said, "Okay." So you guys may not know about Thomas the Train, but this is something little kids are really into these days. American kids and French kids. Although now he's five and he's totally outgrown Thomas the Train. He has no interest in it. But at four, they lugged the whole thing over here on the plane from France to Minneapolis. All the tracks, all the different trains. There's Thomas and there's Herman and there's all these different trains, all these different engines, right? And then there are bridges and there are tunnels, and so all set up in his room in our house. Our house is not very big, a few blocks from here. So, and then his brother, who's one, so my grandson sets it all up in his room, and my grandson, who's one, you know, one and a half, he wants to be in there. He wants to be sucking on Thomas the Train. Right? And so Ethan, you know, Logan can't come in. Don't come in, Logan. So let's look at little Ethan, 4 years old. Let's look at his constructs. His construct first is, there's Logan coming in and starting to suck on Thomas. Which is not something you don't do. Thomas is a train. Thomas is there on the track, not to be sucked on. And so Ethan feels discomfort. He has no comfort. Anger comes out of discomfort. It's an id response, a libido response. Ah! Ah! That's the first layer. The second layer is he's developing ego. He says to himself, maybe he says it while Grandpa is listening, because he's just learning to say these stuffs quietly. You know, he hasn't learned to say them completely to himself yet, but he's practicing. Why Logan doing that? Why Logan doing that? That's ego developing. And then... Mama said, I shouldn't be angry. He's just a baby. Trying to get the parent inside, or internal parent inside. Mama said. Mama said. So he's developing super ego. He's developing the internal parent, but he hasn't quite got it in yet. Mama said. Mama said. And grandpa's just watching all this stuff. Oh boy, I gotta give a talk pretty soon. And so that's how we develop in the world. So now he's 5, and then he'll be 15, and then maybe he'll be a Zen student. But if I wish for him to be a Zen student, he won't, so I won't wish for that. At least I'll try not to wish for that. And then when he becomes a Zen student, he has a chance to practice. He has a chance to practice this awareness of these different layers on his cushion. Awareness of these different layers on his cushion. So when Dogen talks about continuous practice, he talks about two components. He talks about bare awareness, and he talks about total exertion or total engagement. When I was young, I used to prefer the translation total exertion. Now I much prefer total engagement. And there are a lot of the scholars argue about which is the accurate one, and nobody knows. So I'm going to read you something about from continuous practice by Dogen. And in this, he doesn't talk about either bare awareness, shikan. For Dogen, bare awareness is shikan. He doesn't talk about shikan, nor does he talk about total engagement, but in many other places he does. But here's what he says about continuous practice. On the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. This being so, continuous practice is undivided, not forced by you or others. The power of this continuous practice confirms you as well as others. It means your practice affects the entire earth and the entire sky in the 10 directions. Although not noticed by others or by yourself, it is so. Accordingly, by the continuous practice of all Buddhas and ancestors, your practice is actualized and your great road opens up. By your continuous practice, the continuous practice of all Buddhas is actualized. Oh, and the great road opens up. And the great road of all Buddhas opens up. Your continuous practice creates the circle of the way. By this practice, Buddha ancestors abide as Buddha, non-abide as Buddha, have Buddha mind, and attain Buddha without cutting it off. And then subsequent to that, he identifies total engagement and shikan, bare awareness. So that's what we're trying to do in our lives as Zen practitioners. With the left hand of bare awareness and the right hand of total engagement, or the other way around. That's what we're trying to do. And so if we're in retreat and we see these different layers, well, we see the shoulding, we see the impulse to get out of here. A lot of people have that impulse. There has to be a lot of internal parent. You've got to have a strong internal parent to do these sesshins. People say there's no should in Zen. Oh, you've got to be kidding. You've got to be kidding. You have to have a strong internal parent. So we see these layers, we see how ego's trying to modify it, right? Is on our cushion, trying to deal with both of them, the impulse and the shoulding. and then if we're serious in our practice, we add a fourth layer, right? Which is, I'm a serious Zen student. I shouldn't be shoulding. I shouldn't be giving into my impulse, right? And then layers ad infinitum. And all we have to do is be aware of those and then engage. which is quite a bit, quite a bit, quite a bit. So in a recent issue of Tricycle, a guy named Gary Wick, Zen teacher, talks about his practice as a Zen student and coming up against some feeling of inadequacy in his life that he, not just from his Zen practice, that he was been carrying with him for years, and identifying it in his Zen sitting as residing in the pit of his stomach, this inadequacy, this not being okay, in spite of the fact that he got straight A's and got a PhD and was sitting in perfect posture in the Zendo day after day. So he identified that. He saw that. And then he had a little epiphany in a retreat. He's Jewish, and he went to Hebrew school, and his little epiphany, he saw himself in Hebrew school, and he heard the part in the book of Job where God says to, let's see, how does this go? God says to Job that he'll have to sacrifice his son Isaac, and at that time, Gary realized and remembered that even though Isaac was a good boy, look what almost happened to him, and he's much better than me. And that, at a subliminal, preconscious level, he'd been carrying around for all those years, and it just up in his Zen sitting through the practice of Shikan, through the practice of bare awareness. His shadow memory just was accessed, and there was some healing. And of course, we all would like this healing. But if we look for this healing, we don't get it. We only get it by continuous practice. That's the only way we get it. And Zen teachers can also help us with this. My first Zen teacher helped me a lot, and I tell stories all the time about how he helped me. And I'm going to tell abbreviated stories. Let's see, do I have time? I get into these stories. I'm going to tell abbreviated stories, three stories that many of you have heard many times, but I'll try to abridge them with my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And the teacher's pointing out how we get caught on our structure. We get caught on our structure. So the first one is the 60s. That's when I came of age, so to speak. Although in some sense I'm still coming of age. Do we ever come of age? So the 60s, California. That's where I'm from. California in the 60s, right? I'm going to bridge this story. How can I? I mean, you know, how can I do this? You know, the 50s were the superego of American culture. Do you know what I mean? They were the superego of American culture. It was all about should. Everything was should. And what do we do in the 60s? We said, fuck that. Fuck that. It was all about libido. I mean, we didn't say that, but Freud would have said, aha, aha. It was about libido. It was about being in the now. It was about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was about losing your mind and coming to your senses. Remember Fritz Perls? One of you or my age? You may have to be my age for her first girls. Woo! Right? Right? Something's happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? Remember that? Anybody remember that? You got to be old to remember that one. The troubadour of Hibbing was with us, was with me. From when its music first came out, I remember hearing the troubadour in early 63. He stayed with me throughout the 60s, along with Suzuki Roshi. Interesting combination. Oh, the story. You know, see, that's a problem. The story. Okay, so so I drop out of Stanford after Suzuki Roshi set up a nice group for me there where he comes every week and practices. I drop out and I move up to San Francisco to be at the Zen Center, and I kind of I diss my parents. And, you know, what do they know? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, authority, money, materialism, accomplishment, all that stuff, et cetera, et cetera. So I tell Suzuki I've done that. He's not so happy. I said, well, you know, I've done that to be with you, to practice with you. And what does he say to me? You should pay attention to your parents. And I thought, oh, his English isn't very good. That's exactly what I thought. I won't explain this to him. He's never met my dad. I am. So he's just, so he's bringing a little superego in. He's saying, Tim, come on. Come on. The 60 stuff is fine, but they're your parents, and you have an internal parent too. Your very ability to do zazen the way you do, he didn't say that, is because you learned how to develop an internal parent, and you learned that from them. So give them a little credit. He didn't say any of that, but in my practice of my zazen, it took me only about 5 years to realize the importance of what he was saying. Only about 5 years. And after that, I tried to totally engage with him again after cutting off for 5 years. I worked then for 25 years, total engagement with him. I mean, why would I leave them out? My own parents? Why would I leave them out? Total engagement doesn't leave anything out. Second story is the one I've told the most, and it's the hardest to abridge. Here's a, now we're a year or two later, and we have our Zen monastery in Carmel Valley, and I take Suzuki Roshi down to the monastery sometimes. I drive him down from San Francisco to Carmel Valley, and we're driving down, and we're getting ready to start a practice period down there. And he says he wants to stop for what? And you remember what he wants to stop for? What? Coffee. He wants to stop for coffee. And, you know, I'm not very happy. I don't drink coffee. I didn't drink it then. I don't drink it now. Coffee is bad. 50s people drink coffee. I don't drink coffee. I'm a Zen student. And so he wants, well, I knew he already drank coffee, so I thought, we have to stop for coffee. But gee, what a way to get ready to start practicing in the monastery, drink a cup of coffee. That seems totally inappropriate. Totally inappropriate. And so then we this is the banana split story, you guys. So then we get into the cafe, and he orders the coffee and I order water. I mean, water's best. If you're going to start a retreat, start with water. And you're sure you'll be nice and pure and you won't have any extra sediment. So I'm a serious Zen student. Water. Not going to pollute my system before I even get there. So, again, we sit down. He orders coffee. I order water. And at the next table, someone has something that fascinates him that he's never seen before. And he says to me, "What is that?" And you know, it's one of those banana splits that's really, you know, when you look at a banana split and you've never seen it, it got that red thing on the top, that cherry, and then all of that foamy white stuff, and then under that those different colors, and then that brown sauce all around it. He says, "What is that?" Oh, and then the bananas are in there too, right? You've been And I say, oh, that's a banana split. And what does he say? Yeah, I want one of those. And I say, you do. You already have coffee. I want one of those. So we order. He orders a banana split with his coffee. I'm drinking my water. Then he has a little bit of... He looks at it. He comes in front of him and he really looks at it. If you really look at a banana split, you'll be tripped out. Really, just look at it. It's incredible. Oh, he sees the little strawberry and he tastes that, and the chocolate, he tastes that. The cherry on top he doesn't touch. He just tastes the whipped cream around it and watches the cherry, looks at the cherry. And then he says, very interesting. And then he says, what does he say after that? Those of you who heard me say the story. He says, anybody heard, remember what he says? He says, huh? He says, just like America, everything mixed together. And then he pushes it over to me. He's only taken about 3 bites. He says, this is for you. You're American. Well, this whole thing is perturbing for me. It's not funny at the time. It actually pisses me off. And there I have the banana split in front of me, and I love chocolate. And I love strawberry. And I love vanilla. But I haven't had any ice cream for about a month, preparing for my retreat, preparing for practice period. I've been off ice cream. I've been trying to do, I never did macrobiotics, but close to macrobiotics. And there it is. So I end up eating the banana split. And then, you know, once you have a little chocolate, I don't know about you, but once I have a little chocolate, that's it, honey. That's it. Gatte, gatte. And so I eat the whole banana split, and then we go down to, we get to the monastery, and I have a stomach ache for the first hour of Zazen, but then I'm fine after that. Fine after that. So that's a story about, and is he trying to teach me? I don't even think he's trying to teach me, you guys. I think the best teaching from a teacher doesn't come when they try. I think he's just being himself. But it's a huge teaching for me over the years and over my life about getting too rigid and too shoddy about my practice. My practice, my purifying myself. Not staying away from this, staying away from that. Getting up a little earlier so I can, you know, da 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 da. We become Puritan Zen people. So it's just a teaching. And the third one is so that's a teaching about not only not getting caught by super ego, but also enjoying our senses, enjoying our immediate senses. The third one is okay, we're back in San Francisco, and there's a part of San Francisco called North Beach where they had, in those days, really nice, aesthetically pleasing movies. Really, you got the best movies in the world in that part of San Francisco in the 60s, from my point of view. And so I would go over there with my young wife, which is my girlfriend and my wife, and we'd take a bus over there and see movies whenever we could. But at the Zen Center itself, which was a Jewish synagogue, the Zen Center was a Jewish synagogue. It had been a Jewish synagogue. The Japanese bought the Jewish synagogue, and that's where the Zen Center was. And what did they do on Saturday nights? In the main auditorium of the Jewish synagogue, Zen Center, they showed movies. They showed these grade C Japanese shoot 'em up movies, or beat 'em up movies, or sword 'em up movies. You know what I mean? And there'd be these. When I go into Zen, into the temple, I guess it was a temple still, I guess, I'd see these big flyers on the outside on my way in about the Saturday night movie, and So I never went close to those movies. I always went over to North Beach. And Suzuki Roshi had us as his students, and then he had the Japanese as a congregation. The Japanese were supporting him. We didn't give a dime. They never even passed the basket. We just freeloaded in the 60s for a long time off the Japanese people. But that's a different story. He would give talks on Sunday, and then one Sunday he was sleepy, and I said, "You're sleepy." And he said, "Yes, you know, every Saturday night I go to the movie." And I said, "Oh," I said, "You don't go to that movie down in the auditorium, do you?" He said, "Yeah, I go to the movie in the auditorium." And I said, "I'm sorry." I said, "Is there anything about any of them you like?" And what did he say? "I like them all. I like them all." So this is maybe a teaching about, and is he trying to teach me anything? No, I don't think so. I don't think he's trying to teach anything. He just likes them all. He's not, it doesn't mean he doesn't have a refined aesthetic sense. He does in many aspects of his life. But he's able just to kind of be there. Just to be there. And my ego needs to go to North Beach, which is a 2 bus rides and a transfer, are fine. They're fine, but they're somewhat limiting. They're somewhat constrained, so that I'm missing out. Maybe not I'm going to those movies every night, but something similar, something that's going on right in front of me. We're always missing out on something that's going on right in front of us that we can enjoy. So those are those 3 stories. Let's see. I don't think I wonder if I should tell this last one. I don't think so. I think instead, I just want to say that these are examples of how we can use bare awareness and also continuous practice and engaging. And most of these stories I've told about are more about bare awareness than they are about complete engagement. But complete engagement is important too. Complete engagement is important too. We'll have this retreat, people will be done with this retreat, and can we completely engage then in the world? Completely engage in the world. And if we're having a hard time, let's just remember what Dogen's saying about continuous practice. That when we engage, we feel better. We feel better. When we force ourselves to connect, we get in touch with the natural connection that's always going on. And sometimes we just want to withdraw. We just want to withdraw to the Zendo, withdraw to the TV room. That's not total engagement. Total engagement is engaging with the Japanese people who are here wanting me to go to the movie with. And if I really engage with them, I'm going to enjoy the movie because I enjoy their company. So I want to finish by reading another part of this continuous practice by Dogen. Because of this practice, there are the sun, the moon, and the stars. Because of this practice, there are the great earth and the open sky. Because of this practice, there are body, mind, and their environs. Because of this practice, there are the 4 great elements and the 5 skandhas. Continuous practice is not necessarily something in the something people in the world love. I didn't love it when I started trying to reconnect with my parents. It was really awkward. It was really awkward. Their values still seem so out of sync with mine. so antiquated. But if you do this, it loses its awkwardness. If you do this, if you engage with whomever, with whatever, if you give yourself to it, it loses its awkwardness. Continuous practice is not necessarily something people in the world love, but it should be the true place of return for everyone. Because of the continuous practice of all Buddhas of the past, present, and future, all Buddhas of the past, present, and future are actualized. So I have a friend who reads this last paragraph to himself every day, a friend in California, who struggled a lot with loneliness and with feeling isolated. And he reads it, he changes the year to my when he reads it. Continuous practice that actualizes itself is no other than my continuous practice right now. The now of this practice is not originally possessed by the self. The now of this practice does not come and go, enter and depart. The word now does not exist before continuous practice. The moment when it is actualized is called now. This being so, my continuous practice of this day is a seed of all Buddhas and the practice of all Buddhas. All Buddhas are actualized and sustained by my continuous practice. So that's what I want to say for today. More or less. And with continuous practice, there's all kinds of expression that comes out, all kinds of nonverbal and verbal expression, and we can treasure that expression, whether we speak or not.